Hi, and welcome to the Trenches Technology Podcast. I'm your host, Sharon Bueno, Managing Editor of Trenches Technology Magazine. The podcast so far is concentrated on the COVID-19 health crisis and its impact on the trenches industry. Today's episode is a little different as we are honoring our 2020 Trenches Technology Person of the Year, Siggy Finsen. Siggy's been an integral part of the trenches industry for more than 25 years. He has tirelessly trained and educated the HDD community, whether on the road for digital control or presenting at our HDD academies or NASTT educational sessions. He's also played a key role in helping to bring DCI's locating systems to market with his input and as well as carrying the voices of the contractors from the field back to the engineer's drawing table. Now, we normally recognize our Person of the Year winner at the NASTT No Dig Show's annual kickoff breakfast. But these days, as you know, nothing is normal. Still wanted to recognize our 2020 honoree. Welcome, Siggy. I appreciate you taking a few minutes to share your industry story with us. So first off, how are you and your family faring through all this? Personally, in Ohio, we've been under lockdown since March, and it's been extended until the end of May, though some businesses are opening again. So what's the situation for you in the state of Washington?
Good morning, Sharon. It's pretty much the same. We've been locked down since, I want to say, early March, and we are currently locked down through end of May. There's been some talk about a gradual opening, but nothing firm. So as far as we know, we're at least at home through the end of May.
So I was trying to remember the first time I met you, actually, and because I feel like we've kind of grown up in the trenches industry together. And I want to say it has to be like the IQ show, maybe 99, 2001, or maybe the rodeos.
Certainly the rodeos. I don't remember either, Sharon, but it's been a long time since we first met.
I think you're like one of the first people I may have connected with.
I guess that's a good thing, isn't it?
So why don't we start off by just telling everybody a little bit about your background. I know you were born and raised in Iceland and came over to the United States in the mid-80s for a postgraduate degree. So maybe kind of fill us in on that.
Yes, correct. Grew up in Iceland. My family still lives there, but as I had finished my engineering education in Iceland, most of us at the time, meaning Icelandic engineering students, went overseas to graduate school, and I ended up choosing the state of Washington primarily because one of my professors at the University of Iceland had actually gotten his PhD from one of the universities here in the state of Washington. So that brought me to the state of Washington. After I spent a couple of years in graduate school, finished that, and then started looking for a job. First job I actually had, which just coincidentally was with the Robbins Company. Didn't know anything about that industry, very little about tunneling, but ended up working for the Robbins Company for about 6 years. Towards the end of my time with the Robbins Company, microtunneling, this would have been in the early 90s, microtunneling was sort of taken off here in the United States. So I and another engineer at the Robbins Company, we started looking at getting Robbins involved in microtunneling, which meant that we were looking at different publications. Trenches Technology Magazine was something that I didn't really know anything about at the time because that didn't really necessarily cater to the big tunneling. But so in 1995, I for the first time went to a Trenches NASTT show, rather. And this was up in Canada, 1995, I believe, and happened to run into one of my ex-colleagues from the Robbins Company, Craig Caswell, who was there with his boss, John Mercer, from Digital Control. Mm-hmm. And so at this show, just sort of watching what was going on and talking to some people, I became aware of this thing called trench technology, which had been totally unknown to me prior to that time. And so after I came back from the show, continued to have some discussions with Craig and really saw that this trenches technology industry was something that was very much in its infancy. But I saw a lot of interesting things going on there. Mm-hmm. So this is 1995. Things very, very early on in that industry. TBMs, which I came from, was already a well-established industry. Very few players, large projects, multi-million dollar machines. So this was a totally different, environment for me. And so, as it turned out, this would have been, probably March or April that the show was in June. I ended up joining that DCI.
When you joined DCI, did you know anything about horizontal directional drilling in locating systems?
No. I knew other than what I picked up in the 2 months between just reading what I could get my hands on. And again, this is for those who might be younger. Information was a little bit more difficult to come by back then. You'd have to go and find magazines. Where did you find magazines? Maybe in libraries. There was some online presence, but as much as I could get my hands on, I read. But I didn't really know anything about either DCI or its technology when I joined.
So when you joined, that was like the mid-90s.
Yes, 95.
95. What was the trenchless market like at that time? Would you remember?
Yeah, it was, again, I had come from a fairly well-established industry, tunneling. The machines that we were dealing with, Robin's company built, were very sophisticated pieces of machinery. And one of the things that struck me was the difference between the machines that were used in the HDD industry, certainly much smaller, much, much simpler, very, very rudimentary machines. So from a technology standpoint, things were very, very basic. I guess I was fortunate in that when I joined, long haul fiber was just beginning. And so there was a lot of work that needed to be done. And there was this new technology called HDD, which increasingly was being used. And so as I'm starting to sort of get my feet underneath me, and in the next 5 years, there's a lot of work being done. And so between 95 and 2000, a significant number of both contractors joined the industry, but there was a significant amount of advancement coming from the manufacturers. And so I was lucky to join when things were very much in a growth spurt mode. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, early 2000, sort of at the crash of the fiber boom, things went the other direction. But as I said, lots of opportunity, a lot of things going on, and a lot of very, very capable and smart people were joining this industry at that time.
So how has the trenchless industry locating market evolved since those early years? What have you seen?
Well, that particular question might warrant a series of podcasts. So let me see how I can try to distill this down into a few minutes. From the locating standpoint, locators that are used in HD originally were modified utility locators. And so when HDD sort of first started, the locators that were being used really weren't specifically designed for the industry. They were actually a locator used for locating utilities that had been modified. As it turns out, that wasn't necessarily the best way to go. So early on, very rudimentary changes were made to these utility locators, and we had what we call, I guess we could call HDD locators. Back then, very, very simple devices. No remotes, meaning that the operator of the rig didn't know what was going on. He was just relying on the locator up front telling him what was going on. So just very, very basic. So if we now fast forward 25 years, I guess the three biggest differences that if I try to categorize this is that locators have become significantly more complicated. That is meaning a lot more features, but at the same time, they've become a lot easier to use. So a lot of focus has been put on making the locators work more efficiently for a new locator to be able to pick them up more quickly and ultimately making them productive faster. So making the locators as simple to use has been a key component. Another maybe area where there's been significant improvement is in the area of interference. Interference is something that plagues all locators. And by the virtue of the fact that we create a magnetic field, a signal from a transmitter, that field is subject to interference from other utilities. So in the older days, locators didn't really have a very good way of dealing with interference. So significant advancement has been made in that arena, in part basically the idea being if we can get rid of as much of the interference as possible, we end up with much more accurate locators, which ultimately means safer locating. Mm-hmm. Maybe the third area is just in the area of, let's call it data. The data coming from early locators was very scant, depth, maybe pitch and roll. We've now added things like fluid pressure, the fact that the locator itself can log the bore and create as-builts. Some manufacturers have the option of sending these bore logs to the cloud where someone back in the office can read them. So the idea of getting data from the field back to the office very, very quickly in a manner that allows businesses to move much faster is maybe the third area where there's been the biggest improvement.
You've worked on the new installation side of trenchless for almost all of your career. What is it about like HCD and trenchless that kind of keeps you interested in what you like so much about it?
Well, it's in many ways, I think it has a lot to do, frankly, with the people in this industry. I mean, obviously, my colleagues at DCI, but even some of my competitors with whom I have a very good relationship. So the people that are involved is something that is something that's kind of kept me keen. And the fact that this is a very, very necessary industry. Most people typically don't pay any attention to what's in the ground, i.e., I'm just an average citizen. I hit the switch and my lights come on, and I flush the toilet, and maybe now more importantly, my internet is working. So as long as all these things are working, most people don't give any thought to the amount of work that goes into making sure that this all happens. And so the fact that we're involved in an industry that is key in keeping people's everyday lives functioning is actually very rewarding.
Now you have an engineering background. Your dad is an engineer. How has the role of the engineer evolved in trenchless technology over the years?
So I guess we can talk briefly and I won't spend much time. Obviously the manufacturers of HDD equipment have always had engineers. So there's always been these engineers that are building and designing the thing. But I maybe the biggest change I think has come from the engineers representing the design side of things, city utility engineers. When I first started, this was very, very much an unknown technology. People have been putting pipes in the ground for well over 100 years, and it's been done in the same way for a long, long time. We dig a trench, we put a pipe in it, and we fill it up, and there we are. So early on, I think a lot of my time and probably other manufacturers' time was spent just convincing engineers that this was actually a viable alternative to what they had been doing for all these years. So early on, as I said, a lot of educational effort. I think one of the biggest differences I see now is that many universities have exposed their students to HDD. There are now NASTT student chapters at various universities. So we are graduating younger engineers that actually have been exposed and in some cases even written master's or PhD thesis related to trenchless technology. So the educational effort on the university side, I think, has been a big improvement. And so over those last 25 or so years, it used to be I had to explain to people what either HD or trenchless technology was. And now that's not the case anymore. People have heard of it, some more than others, but there's still much education work that remains. And I think that's one of the reasons why things like the Nodic shows are so important. That's an opportunity for engineers to come and learn what's going on. It's an opportunity for us who are involved on the manufacturing side of things to share with the industry what's going on, what new things we have, and it's an opportunity for networking where an engineer in one part of the country can learn from an engineer in a different part. So I think by and large, education has been significantly improved, but I still run into people that haven't really given much thought to or really that familiar with HDD. So we can't let up.
Well, you do quite a few presentations throughout the year. Like I said, whether it's the HDD Academy or NASDT, do you see the audience differently? They're coming in more educated to these sessions?
Definitely. They're coming in a lot more educated. Obviously, those of us who live and breathe these things 10, 12 hours a day, we always think that, well, I'm surprised that they don't know this. But yes, there's definitely the sort of 101 presentations. We don't need to do those very much anymore. Everybody comes in with a basic understanding, and I'm really looking for now more depth. And so early on, it was very, very basic. Here's what this thing is. Now we're into more technical solutions and questions related to, well, in this situation, how do we deal with that? So yeah, audience is definitely more educated.
And that's always a good thing.
It is a good thing. Someone is doing something right. And I think part of it, frankly, is just the fact that you guys, the magazines, anybody who's involved with these shows, it would be interesting to just think of the number of presentations that have been made at the various NODIC shows over the years. Mm-hmm. They're probably in the tens of thousands. And so it is that effort, along with magazines and of course what the individual manufacturers do, I think we're making some headway.
So you've been, like I said, been in the industry for 25 some years. What did you learn early on in your career that you apply to how you do your work today? Is there any lessons that you apply?
Well, it's an interesting question. One of the early things that my father told me, who was an engineer as well, this is while I was still in engineering school, mired in math and physics and those kinds of things. He said, 85% of your job eventually will be communications. And I really didn't know what he meant by that. But obviously, as anybody who works with people, and it doesn't really matter what field you're in, I think you very quickly learn that the ability to communicate is just as, if not much more important than your technical skills, the ability to be able to work as a part of a team. And so in the engineering world, it's all about teamwork. There's nothing that is done, I believe, at any engineering type endeavor where you just have a single person working on it. You have a whole host of people. And so communications is very, very important. And the notion of a team, growing up, I played, I guess you would call it competitive soccer. I like to call it football. But so I have almost my entire life been part of a team of some sorts. Early on, sports teams, later on, design teams. But the notion that it's the team that accomplishes something. Yes, there are stats, if we use the team analogy, who scored the goals, or I guess in America, the touchdowns. But ultimately, it's the team that won. And as you look further back, it was the team that accomplished something, not necessarily the individual. So I've always been very keen on the notion of a team, and in the teams that I've been involved with, either led or just as a participant, I've always tried to get as much as possible from every team member, because ultimately, the goal is to get something done. And we have to have, again, in every endeavor, you have to have everybody who is involved. You have to have them contributing. And so these are all things that none of these things I think were discussed in engineering school. Maybe in hindsight, it would have been worthwhile teaching us what it meant to be a engineer, or a member of an engineering team, not so much about the intricacies of stresses and strains and beams, but and so it's interesting as I sit here and look back, is that the engineering education itself, although very valuable, there's all these other softer skills that we weren't taught that really have, I think, come to the forefront as being what you need.
I remember when I interviewed you for the profile I did for the Person of the Year, you talked a lot about soccer, and you quoted someone, you know, a soccer quote.
Yes.
Do you remember what it was?
That's Bill Shankly, and I'm paraphrasing. He said something along the lines, some people think football is a matter of life and death. And he says, I don't agree with that. It's much more serious than that. And so, not sure that I think it's more important than life and death, but it's awfully close. It's been a part of my life, my entire life. My kids, all of them, including my oldest son, played soccer at a very, very high level. So we have been very much a soccer family. And I'm very much missing my early Saturday mornings where I would get up and have a cup of coffee and watch English football at 5 or 6 in the morning. And that, of course, is on hold like everything else.
Yeah, sports definitely missing this right about now. I'm missing baseball right now.
Yes.
So when we contacted you, informed you that you were named our Person of the Year, to say you were surprised, I don't know if that's a correct description. You were surprised, but I'm trying to think of a better word. So what were your thoughts when it sunk in that you were selected our Person of the Year?
Surprised, I guess, is a good word. It was interesting. Rob Chris called me, and he was kind of humming and hawing about what the call was all about. And this was prior to the HDD Academy, so I was immediately assuming it had something to do with that he was calling to check on something. But surprised, I guess. Humbled is another way of putting it. I mean, if you look at the people that I have had the opportunity to work with or get to know, some very impressive people. So I was very humbled to have been chosen as being at the same level as these people.
Well, we think you were an awesome selection.
Well, thank
for everything you've done over your time in the industry.
I appreciate that. It's been a very pleasant surprise. Yes, and I've had people reach out to me, and I think after the article came out, and just congratulate and just check in and say hi. And especially nowadays, when I would have been meeting most of these people earlier in April at the show, and so none of that happened. So I appreciate the I guess the contact that has come as part of that.
Now, before we wrap things up, I wanted to get your perspective on how this pandemic has affected the trenchless market, maybe some short and long-term thoughts on its impact.
So as best as we can tell, obviously there is a significant amount of uncertainty with everybody. But most of the contractors that we hear from continue to be busy. So in the very, very short term, as far as the work is concerned, that hasn't been impacted too much. There are other things like permitting seems to take longer. Inspecting out on site is more complicated because you just can't waltz up to site anymore. So things are just, I think everything has taken more time. Mm-hmm. Because of obvious considerations, locating your utilities, everything has kind of slowed down a little bit, but the work doesn't appear to have gone away. But back to the uncertainty, I think, until things start approaching some sort of normalcy, whatever new normal looks like, I think there will be certainly uncertainty and some hesitancy from contractors.
How has it changed how DCI approaches business? I mean, we in the short term, don't have any trade shows going forward. And customer visits, I would imagine, are sporadic or if not happening right now. So how has it changed the way DCI is doing its business?
It certainly has, although it's interesting to think about what this pandemic has forced everybody to do. It's forced everybody to really start thinking about what it means to work remotely. And if nothing else, it certainly has underscored the necessity of having a very robust communication infrastructure. And I'm not sure that the people who are working from home and telecommuting really realize the industry that is actually making it possible for them mm-hmm. to do all these things. So I think as an industry, we have an opportunity to highlight whenever things get a little bit back to normal. We have an opportunity to highlight the value that this industry brings to just this particular situation by making sure that the communications are solid and the work that these contractors do day in and day out to broaden and widen that. As far as DCI is concerned, I think late February, early March is when we started working from home. That is anybody who can. That means the entire engineering team. Those of us who work in product management, I haven't been in the office, I think, in 2 months now. And so we continue to meet virtually as opposed to in person. Most of the work that we do on the engineering side has been online for quite some time. Although we're all sitting in the same office, we communicate via electronic means. So the fact that we're now at home really hasn't changed that too much. As far as our field managers are increasingly doing online training. You put on a sort of an impromptu webinar, if you would. And mm-hmm. Since everybody is sort of in the same situation, they're not out and about. We've actually found it easier to schedule a lot of these things. And so DCI is starting to move a lot of the training online. And I wouldn't be surprised if that is something that that is going to continue, and that is something that we just did out of necessity early on or before this. Now I think it's part of just how we do things. As far as the trade shows, yes. I don't think you can ever replace a trade show and do it virtually. So not having those certainly been a loss, but those will undoubtedly return. So I know that NODIC has now been sort of moved back to October, I believe, up in mm-hmm. Canada, which is just a couple of hours north of me. So that's good. customer visits, which used to be person to person, now have increasingly just become phone calls. And so a lot of work is being done just checking up on people. Each of our field managers has an area of responsibility. So they're calling their customers and just checking in on them. And so it's, I think everybody is learning to make do with this new normal. And DCI, although we've always had a lot of online content, we have a large YouTube channel, for example, we're continuing to evolve. And I think we're much more, strategically thinking about how we use the online, world to reach out to people.
Well, that wraps up another Conscious Technology podcast. I want to thank my guest, Siggy Finson, for joining us today. To read more about Siggy and his story, check out my profile of him in the March issue of Conscious Technology, which can be found at conscioustechnology.com. Until next time, everyone, stay safe and be well.